McClancy trial ends in a mistrial. What will come next for the mother who killed her three children? The new jobs report is out, far exceeding expectations. We'll tell you who's hiring. Plus, Senator John Fetterman is getting blasted by some of his fellow Democrats after a scathing report claims he's ducking his duties, even skipping a police funeral in his own home state. Hello, I'm Nicole Killian in for Major Garrett, and welcome to The Takeout. It was a 41-day ordeal that both horrified and transfixed the nation. Was Lindsay Clancy legally responsible for the killing of her three young children? And 41 days later, we are no closer to an answer, as the judge has ruled a mistrial. And just as with every other part of this trial, the arrival at that decision came with drama and high tension. The defense questioned the judge's handling of a lone juror who was accused of refusing to follow the judge's instructions on burden of proof.
I would ask that you not just give them, as I described it yesterday, a soft inquiry. Will you listen to my instructions? I would ask that you specifically direct their attention to proof beyond a reasonable doubt and re-instruct them on that forcefully.
I think I did that yesterday, didn't I?
Yes.
You did it yesterday. You did it soft. You didn't do it forcefully. And I'm asking,
what do you want me to do?
I want
get
you to tell
get a brass band. I read the instruction as written by the SJC. The
right.
Fact that I perhaps didn't give it my full inflection, I'm sorry about that. I'm not an actor. I'm just given the instructions. And I'll try and give this with more pizzazz than I gave yesterday, I suppose.
The defense's last-ditch appeal to have that juror removed failed. The judge made the announcement everyone had been anticipating since the jury first announced their deadlock.
At this point, I'm going to declare that the jury is deadlocked, and I'm going to declare a mistrial.
The question now, will the prosecution retry Lindsay Clancy? They won't say. We start off with CBS News correspondent Chanel Call, who joins us from outside the courthouse tonight. And Chanel, take us inside the courtroom. I know you have been covering this case from start to finish, but how was the judge's declaration received?
Yeah, and Nicole, it's not even over yet, right? There was a lot of tension heading into today. I mean, I think there was a lot of anticipation that there would be some kind of finality or decision made at the end of today. The gallery was distraught. It was chaotic. People were trying to get in. There were so many community members that not everybody could actually get into court and be seated. Once it all started, once we found out that this was, in fact, going to be a mistrial, our reporters who were inside the courtroom, Nicole, tell me that, you know, there were women there with their heads in their hands. There was, you know, a woman who was seen sort of biting her nails, seemed nervous. There were people sort of tapping their knees in nervousness. I just think that there was so much anticipation this was going to end in a certain way for a lot of people who were here to support Lindsay Clancy, that they didn't want to see a mistrial. Lindsay herself, she was looking straight. She seemed composed. She seemed serious. Her dad, I noticed, you know, seemed to be quite devastated. He looked quite distressed once the news came down. And I don't think this is the way Lindsay Clancy or her attorney wanted things to end today.
So what happens next?
That's the big question, right? Prosecutors have not said at this point whether or not they plan to try the case again. I think that's what everybody assumed would happen, including Kevin Reddington, because at the end of that court session today, he was actually like ready to set another date. He said, let's come back next Tuesday. But that's not what we heard from the DA, who spoke to reporters outside the courthouse today. We heard from both him, Timothy Cook, and from Kevin Reddington after all this happened this afternoon, and they characterized this case very differently.
It's not right what she had to go through, because she grieves the loss of those three children, Cora, Dawson, and Callan, because I know their names. I don't have to look down at a piece of paper and find out what their names are. And every time somebody had something to say about those young kids, Lindsay would smile and say, I'm glad. She wants them to be remembered.
Children were murdered, and it's our job to seek justice.
I appreciate the fact that there are strong feelings and opinions tied to this case.
Nicole, as for what all of this means for Lindsay Clancy, as we understand it, she will be held at the same psychiatric facility where she is right now until it's determined whether or not there will be another trial.
All right, Chanel Call, thank you so much. I want to talk more about today's development with CBS News legal contributor and criminal defense attorney Caroline Polisi. Thank you so much for joining us. Of course, we saw the jury deadlock several times this week. Was a mistrial inevitable here?
Well, it seems like it, Nicole, especially getting down to these last few hours and days with those back and forth notes from the jurors. I mean, the first time a jury tells the judge that they're at a deadlock, it's within his discretion to tell them to go back and try again. Well, that happened here, and then we got another note saying they were still a deadlock. And then the judge issued a more formal charge known as the 2E charge, telling them really try your hardest. The law favors coming to a verdict. And then we got this twist, okay, about this one juror, this rogue juror who apparently was not following the law. And then that ignited a whole set of circumstances wherein Kevin Reddington actually tried to appeal this decision to stay the pending jury deliberations to get to the highest court in the state of Massachusetts. I mean, a lot of drama involved in this case. The end just ultimately very gut-wrenching, unsatisfying. And, you know, I think Kevin Reddington feels that if that one juror had been removed, he would have gotten an acquittal in this case.
So why didn't the judge remove the juror?
Honestly, because it wasn't proper. It wasn't necessary. Yes, one juror did accuse another juror of knowing the law but not following the law, which could be improper. However, the judge decided and the prosecution argued that there was no indication that this was nothing more than merely a difference of opinion, which is what the system is meant to do, right? An 11-1 breakdown is perfectly, you know, it's that happens sometimes. It's not necessarily that somebody is actively disregarding the law. The highest court agreed that this wasn't a case where judicial intervention was required, such that that juror would need to be removed and replaced by an alternate. That would be a very drastic remedy. And ultimately, a mistrial was declared. And I think that was the right call here.
And so what are the next steps for the prosecution?
Look, we heard those were fighting words from both, the prosecutor, the DA, as well as Kevin Reddington. They both seem really sort of dug in on their positions. But I do think it's interesting that you didn't see the DA doubling down immediately, saying that they would retry these cases on three counts of first degree murder. I think perhaps cooler heads will prevail in the coming days and weeks, thinking through the prosecution's thinking through this case. If it really is an 11-1 split, does it serve the interests of justice to move forward with the retrial, or should they think about a plea deal?
All right. Caroline Polisi, also closely watching this case, and I'm sure the developments to follow. We appreciate you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Energy Secretary Chris Wright is back in the United States after his trip to Venezuela to hash out the new oil deal between the two nations. The agreement gives the United States control over roughly one-fifth of Venezuela's oil reserves. Wright says the deal should lead to lower gas prices for Americans within the next year or two. CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent and Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan joins me now. And Margaret, thanks so much for being with us. I know you'll be talking more with the secretary about this, but, talk to us a little bit about his assertion that this deal will lead to lower gas prices, particularly since we're seeing, for instance, diesel prices right now hit a record of $5.85 per barrel. How is he threading the needle here on this?
Well, and just to hear you say there, in a year or two. That is not...
Doesn't do much before the midterms.
Not at all. We're like 60 days out from the midterms. Yeah. So time's the ticking for people to actually experience when they fill up on the consumer side at the gas pump and they are seeing, you know, prices above $4. You just mentioned diesel, which is often referred to as really the lifeblood of America's transportation industry. That matters because those hikes show up in your food prices in the grocery store because they're passed along to consumers. When those big tankers that get filled up with diesel, they have to pay more. That ends up your problem. So that is very much a consumer issue, a political issue. So the timing really couldn't be worse for this spike to be happening. And so it does appear President Trump is trying to get caught trying, right? As Secretary Wright is saying, look, we are building out, things will get better. We hope to have more supply. But in terms of the turnaround for your pocket, that's going to take more time. We'll also speak about that with the chairman of Sunoco, who is going to be on the program this Sunday.
And I want to ask you about another story. I know you're closely watching overseas. We heard President Trump earlier today say that he is sending Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, his son-in-law Jared Kushner, to Russia and Ukraine to present this proposal to end the war there. Let's take a listen.
Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff are expected to go to Kyiv and Moscow. Are they bringing with them new proposals?
No, they're bringing with them a proposal to end the war. Because I ended eight wars. I hope you're proud of me. I ended eight wars. I get no credit for it. I ended eight wars. Did I get the Nobel Prize? No. Although the person that got it was nice enough that she gave it to me.
So what do we know about this proposal, and can this war be ended?
Well, the two envoys are really just trying to revive, attempt to revive long-stalled diplomacy. We don't know that there's actually anything new in the proposal the president is having them bring to Moscow. Remember, it was just last week the CIA director was in Moscow with a warning for Vladimir Putin, do not escalate and do not get more aggressive against other European countries that are in NATO. But what is significant here is what we do know has changed is the situation on the ground. Ukraine has gained some momentum that has changed President Trump's thinking about President Zelensky. He's a bit warmer towards him, thinks he's a winner, not a loser, as you might have heard him referring to him in the past. But what we know with that is that just getting Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner on a plane to Kyiv is an achievement in and of itself. There have been at least a half dozen trips to Moscow that carried out by Steve Witkoff. There have been zero to Ukraine. The last high-level official that I know of was the Secretary of the Army when he went last November to try to learn from Ukraine. That Secretary of the Army, Dan Driscoll, no longer in the Trump administration.
Well, we'll see what comes out of this. Margaret Brennan, we know you'll be covering it. Thank
Believe
you so
it
much.
When we see it.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, you can catch Energy Secretary Chris Wright on Face the Nation this Sunday, as well as Colorado Democratic Congressman Jason Crow. That is on CBS at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. A strong showing from the August jobs report, which exceeded some economists' expectations. 162,000 jobs were added last month, and the unemployment rate stayed unchanged at 4.1%. Let's bring in CBS's Emily Pandice for more. And Emily, good to see you. Break down these new numbers. What sectors showed the most growth?
Nicole, so as you mentioned, a lot of economists were pleasantly surprised by this report. One economist I spoke to this morning described it as a wow report. So some of the sectors that did the best were local government jobs, which saw a bit of a dip last month. Manufacturing and healthcare are always really solid. And one surprisingly strong sector this month was food services and drinking places. We were kind of expecting more of a bump there during World Cup season. So it was great to see that bump in August and that gain in jobs. And the other thing about this report that was important was the revisions from the past 2 months. This summer had been looking kind of lackluster on the jobs front. As you might remember, we initial estimates showed a loss in jobs in July. This report revised some of those estimates to show positive growth. And I think overall, right now, the markets are pricing in a 60-40% chance of a rate hike next week. I think because the labor market is showing some strength, because it is showing that it can tolerate a rate hike if inflation comes in hotter than expected next week, I think we're anticipating the Fed will hike rates to curb that inflation. Nicole?
And to that point, obviously, we saw the markets close down at the end of this week despite these robust job numbers. So what is some of the rationale for that sell-off, or is it linked to this possible rate increase?
Definitely. I think a couple of Fed governors have been out in the past couple of days talking about how important the inflation report is going to be for a rate hike. I think this jobs report showing the strength. There's been a bit of a market sell-off. All three major indices closed in the red today, and that's because people are anticipating a rate hike. Of course, a rate hike is good in that it can help to curb inflation and slow borrowing, slow some of that spending, especially by companies. But the flip side is that it costs more money to borrow money. So, you know, your credit card interest rates go up, your mortgage rates can go up, and overall it can cause a slowdown in the economy in that way.
And also I want to touch on this issue of wage growth. It kind of remains sluggish at 3.1%, the lowest since May of 2021. What do you make of that?
So this wage growth number, annually we saw 3.1% growth over the past year. And a couple of things there. It really means that people don't have as much leverage as they would like when it comes to, you know, getting a new job, asking for that raise, making more money. People aren't as successful as they perhaps have been in the past. And the other thing we're going to be watching carefully for is next week's inflation report. You know, last month inflation was 3.4% annually. So right now, wage growth not keeping pace with inflation. We'll be waiting and watching closely to see how that inflation number comes in next week to see if these wages have kept pace with those rising prices. Nicole?
All right, Emily Pandeis, thank you so much. Still to come here on The Takeout, California candidate for governor Steve Hilton, why he thinks he can be the state's first Republican governor since Arnold Schwarzenegger. Also, President Trump's threat to sue a left-leaning think tank over a report on National Guard deployments. I'll talk to the organization's CEO. Plus, we finally made it to college football season. The games to watch during this weekend's slate of action. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. California's Republican candidate for governor, Steve Hilton, is putting out new policy proposals in his campaign against Democratic competitor Javier Becerra. This includes calling for the state to ban smartphones in schools. Steve Hilton joins us now. And Steve, thanks so much for being with us. Of course, I'm a parent. I know a lot of parents out there want to cut their kids' phone time or screen time. At the same time, they still need a way to get in touch with their kids. So why do you think this ban is necessary and how would it work?
Well, I've been hearing it up and down the state. As you can see, we're on the road right now. We've been doing hundreds of events up and down California, thousands and thousands of people coming out in the last few months to see us. Now, top of the list of things they want me to fix is the cost of living. And I got some very clear plans on that. Your first 150 grand tax-free, gas prices down to $3. But this issue of smartphones and screens is such a big one for parents. I'm a parent. And the problem is that there's this issue of peer pressure. Most parents actually don't want their kids to have smartphones, especially at a really early age. But there's this peer pressure. Everyone else has one. And so the thing that's really started in the last few years is a movement called wait until eighth grade to give your kids smartphones. It's a parent-led movement, grassroots movement. There's already 155,000 parents have signed up to that in California. What I want to do as governor is put the weight of the state behind that. So we invite every parent through the school to make a pledge voluntarily, not a ban, but voluntarily say, we're not going to give our kids smartphones till eighth grade. That means there's no peer pressure there because you can't say, well, I need a smartphone because my friend's got one. If everyone knows that no one else has got one, that makes it easier for parents.
Yeah, but how do you change the culture? You know, do you think schools will go along with this?
Well, we do run the public school system. And so we already have a ban on smartphones in schools in California, but it's not enforced. That's another part of my plan to enforce that bell-to-bell ban, which other states have done with really great results in terms of attentiveness and kids just talking to each other and having human interactions at mealtimes, chatting rather than being glued to their screens. But the other point you raise, which is a very good one, which is, you know, parents may still want to keep in touch. You can do that through a basic phone. It doesn't have to be a smartphone. In fact, I don't have a smartphone. This is the phone that I use. It's a flip phone. I mean, I'm running for governor and I don't have a smartphone. So I think a 9-year-old kid will be fine.
Keeping it old school, I see. You know, you also, in terms of kids and families, while we're on this topic, you have proposed increasing paid family leave from 8 weeks to 12 weeks. You've also proposed creating a home help program for new parents. How are you going to pay for this?
So the proposal to make sure that we have 12 weeks paid leave. That's actually a pretty small change. Right now, the entitlement is 12 weeks, but it's only paid up to 8 weeks. So I just want to close that gap so that for people, especially working class parents, that's a real 12 weeks. Because if you don't get paid, it's very difficult to make that happen unless you've got the means to do that. That costs about $1 billion a year to make that happen. And so we've already laid out a plan called Operation Zero Waste, which starts to delete items from the budget in California that we don't need. Top of that list is high-speed rail. That costs way more than $1 billion a year. In terms of the home helps, we think that's about $2.5 billion a year. That's going to be a voluntary program. But in the home, I mean, I remember this as a new parent. You've got a new baby arriving. You know, it's very stressful. There's a lot going on. Just having someone to in your home every now and again coming in to offer help, it could be a nurse, a retired health professional giving you practical advice. It can be a lifesaver in that situation. I want to make sure that's available to every California family.
I also want to ask you very quickly, President Trump this week expressed support for a federal film tax credit. You have also introduced your own plan earlier this year to provide more incentives to bring production back to Hollywood and California. Did you consult at all with the president on this?
Well, I've been working very closely with Jon Voight, who's a good friend of mine and a supporter, and his team.
And he, too,
and
met
he's
with
been the
president.
That's right. And he's really been leading the work with the White House on this. My plan, actually, I think will make the bigger difference, because what we're seeing is, I'm just on my way to Los Angeles now. We're right by the freeway. Los Angeles's economy is really suffering as a result of so many jobs. It's not just the stars, it's the blue collar jobs, the set builders, the hair and makeup artists, the drivers, also the bars and restaurants that support production. It's a disaster for our economy. Some of those jobs are moving to other countries, but also to other states in America. And so we need to do a lot more here in California, both in terms of our own tax incentive, making it bigger and less bureaucratic, but also getting rid of some of the rules and regulations that are driving production out. My plan is called Bring Hollywood Home, and that's what we're going to do.
And then just lastly, super quick, I know the president endorsed your campaign. At the same time, you've put a little distance between you and the president with respect to some of your proposals. But as you know, he'll be headlining a midterm convention next week in Dallas. Do you plan to attend? Yes or no?
No, I'm not going to be there. I'm focused on seeing as many people as I can in California and traveling our state. Look, I'm honored to have the endorsement of the president as a new and proud American citizen. But as I say to the millions of moderate Democrats and independents in California, whatever you think of President Trump, that's your choice. This is not a federal election we're talking about. You can be anti-Trump and still vote for me for the practical things I want to do to give you your first $150,000 tax-free, no state income tax, $3 gas, cut utility bills in half, starter homes for young families. These are simple, practical things that everyone can get behind.
All right, Steve Hilton, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Very, very good to be with you.
And coming up, first air traffic controllers had to suffer through a government shutdown. Now their pay is being held hostage. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. A pair of Democratic senators is accusing the head of the Federal Aviation Administration of holding pay raises for air traffic controllers hostage. In a letter exclusively obtained by CBS News, Illinois Senators Tammy Duckworth and Dick Durbin say FAA Administrator Brian Bedford is failing to deliver the remaining 2.8% raise that President Trump signed into law earlier this year. So far, air traffic controllers have only received a 1% raise, but Bedford says the workforce needs to, quote, unlock more productivity. CBS News senior transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve has more on this. And Chris, why aren't these air traffic controllers getting their full pay raises?
Well, the FAA says that this piece of legislation that set aside $140 million to give controllers a pay raise did set certain benchmarks that need to be met. One is improving some workplace situations, and that it's at the sole discretion of the FAA administrator. The FAA administrator says they need to fix, as in his words, unlock productivity, fix some workflow issues, might be another way of saying it, in order to justify releasing this raise. What we're hearing from air traffic controllers is that they just feel like that this raise is being withheld from them at the same time as the administration has been talking about how there aren't enough air traffic controllers, and that is forcing, in some cases, controllers to work mandatory overtime in six-day weeks. So it is a complicated, muddled message for sure. But a lot of this grows out of comments that the administrator made during an interview with the Washington Examiner. Take a listen to this.
If you look at the 2026 controller workforce plan, it's actually spelled out in there. We talk about all the things that we feel like we need to do to unlock more productivity.
Are they not being productive enough?
Well, again, as I said, I think the data is really, really poor.
Is that their fault, though? If you know, if they're being assigned shifts or told what to do, they're doing the job, you know, maybe they could be more productive, but...
Well, this isn't about fault. This is about decades of practice that have become just the reflex.
So the FAA would say that the number of useful, like working in the seat hours that a controller does during their eight-hour shift has dropped to about 4 hours a day. They'd like to see it at 5 hours a day. They'd like to be able to have the flexibility to change staffing around, to focus staffing when there are more aircrafts to control. That requires working out an agreement with the union. The senators say that frankly, the legislation, Nicole, created a low bar to unlock this raise, and that if they've not been able to do it, then there's a problem with what the FAA is proposing, and they're calling on the administrator to give the controllers their raise now.
All right, Chris Van Cleave with that exclusive reporting. Hopefully this can get resolved soon. Thanks. President Trump is threatening a defamation lawsuit against the left-leaning think tank Center for American Progress. The president's legal team warned that it could file a $5 billion lawsuit against the organization if it doesn't retract a report that found no evidence that the National Guard's deployment to some U.S. cities reduced violent crime. The Center for American Progress has called the threat, quote, utterly absurd. And we are joined now by the CEO of the Center for American Progress, Neera Tanden. She also served as the director of the Domestic Policy Council under President Joe Biden. Thank you so much for being with us. And so, you know, in terms of this report, I know it's still on your website. So do you have any plans to take this down? And if you don't, are you concerned that the president and his legal team could make good on this threat?
Yeah, we do not plan to retract this report because the report is a factual report. The report really looked at cities that had the National Guard deployments, looked at cities that didn't have the National Guard deployments, looked at the trend lines before and during the National Guard deployments, and found that the rate of violent crime, gun homicides, murders did not change. Crime is coming down, but the rate wasn't impacted, whether it was cities that had National Guard deployments or not. So the report is really making a factual analysis, and that factual analysis is that we cannot see an impact from the National Guard deployment. So we are not going to retract a report that is factual. We see this as an escalation of attacks, not just on the media, but now on a research institution. And despite the threat of a $5 billion lawsuit, we stand by the report.
And can you share more of those specific findings from the report?
Yes. So we looked at the cities like Washington, D.C., other cities that had deployments. And then we looked at cities that didn't across the country. Obviously, there's only a few cities with National Guard deployments. And we really examined from crime data by the federal government whether there was any differential impact from National Guard deployments or not, whether you could expect to see a bigger increase in reductions in cities that had National Guard deployments versus cities that didn't. We didn't find that. We didn't see, in fact, we saw the trend was faster of violent crime coming down before the deployments. We've had a long-term decline over the last two or three years on crime rates. So it was a factual analysis. It's all of the models are actually in the report. If people have questions about those models, they we welcome that conversation. You know, we're a research institution. People can discuss that. But threatening us with a defamation suit for a report the president doesn't seem to like seems beyond the pale.
I know the FBI found, or their numbers reveal, that violent crime did go down, at least from 2024 to 2025. Do you see any merit in those numbers?
Absolutely. I want to be really clear about this. Crime has come down. We acknowledge that in this report. We acknowledge the report came down, violent crime, murder, et cetera, came down in these cities. The question is, did the National Guard deployments have an impact on those crime rates? And what you see when you look across the country is that cities that had no National Guard deployments had a decline in crime as well. So what we're saying is there was no impact on the crime rate. We're very clear about this in the report, and it's very specific. I think the president didn't like the report. That's totally fair. Happy to talk about that. But the idea that an institution criticizing or critiquing a federal policy would be subject to a defamation lawsuit by the president personally, I mean, that is a stretch beyond where the law has been.
I want to turn just very quickly to another round of politics in terms of the midterms. Obviously, we're roughly 60 days out. And this election cycle, you've been extremely outspoken against far left and socialist candidates. So how do you view the state of the Democratic Party right now? And do you see a path where Democrats can take back potentially both chambers?
Absolutely. I've been critical of some on the left, some of the candidates on the left. But I want to say that when you look across the country, you have in most swing states and most states where we have contested races, you have really practical Democrats running on how to lower costs. And I think you'll see across the country that Democrats will do well in the election cycle because they are focused on lowering costs when, unfortunately, the president has been really focused on raising costs.
I want to ask you one other quick question, just because in the last couple of weeks, we have heard from both former First Lady Jill Biden and her son Hunter Biden as well about her husband's cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Former president, obviously working closely with him. I'm just curious if you have talked to him lately, if you have a sense of how he's doing.
I haven't spoken to the President Biden in several months, but I hear that he is in good health and strong. He obviously has a very serious diagnosis, but he's been out there talking, doing endorsements, doing events. So I'm hoping he'll recover and recover soon.
All right, Ira Tandon, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, a new piece in the Wall Street Journal says John Fetterman is checked out. Our reporter panel will discuss the beating that he is taking from some in his own party. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. CBS News has obtained text messages between Senator John Fetterman and staffers that reveal he appears uninterested in doing his work in Congress. The story was first reported by The Wall Street Journal. One example they raised was Fetterman canceling a meeting with paralyzed military veterans at the last minute because he wasn't feeling well, only to appear on Fox News soon after. Another, a staffer, told Fetterman about a funeral for three police officers killed near his hometown, expected to last about 3 hours. Text messages show Fetterman backed out because it was too long, calling it, quote, a non-starter. CBS News has reached out to the senator for a response. I want to turn now to our reporter panel here at the Takeout Tavern on this Labor Day Friday. Riley Rogers is a House leadership reporter for Politico, and Dave Leventhal is a senior editor for Notice. And really want to start off with your take, Riley. I mean, what do you make of this new reporting?
I am from Pennsylvania and from the Philadelphia area. And one of the text messages that came out in that Wall Street Journal report was about the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And I can say it's a huge issue that people in the Philadelphia area really care about, and particularly in those Philadelphia swingy suburbs. So I think as Senator Fetterman is thinking about running for re-election, this is a constituency he might not want to make mad. And I also noticed that two prominent Pennsylvania lawmakers, Congressman Brendan Boyle and Congressman Chris DeLuzio were quick to be on social media condemning this report, as saying, you know, Senator Fetterman is lazy and not up to the task. So definitely on primary watch there, and curious to see how this plays out.
I mean, do you think this is an effort to jockey for a seat should he decide not to run?
Oh, you better believe it. I mean, this is politics here, and the knives are particularly stabby, and they're coming not from the usual suspects and not from Republicans who, frankly, would love, many of them, to see John Fetterman come over and become a Republican. They're coming from the Democrats, too. And also, too, there was a count that popped up today on X, social media account, that purports to be from former staffers of John Fetterman, and they seem to be very willing to burn and trash him in any which way that they can. Keep an eye on that.
Riley, I also want to talk to you about in North Carolina. We know, obviously, again, 60 days out from the midterms, just about here. North Carolina, of course, is sending out mail ballots to voters starting today. Yet at the same time, we know that the president is pushing additional restrictions on mail-in ballots, even taking this appeal up now to the Supreme Court. How do you see this all playing out?
So it's really interesting. Congressman Joe Morelli, he's the top congressman on the House Administration, or the top Democrat on the House Administration Committee. He's been tapped by Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries to oversee election security for Democrats. He went to Politico's headquarters yesterday, and we put questions about this situation to him. And his response is that he's fairly confident the courts will protect mail-in voting. And he said he was watching to see how things went today and making sure that North Carolina was able to get those mail-in ballots out. What's also interesting is that Congressman Morelli told us that House Democrats have been wargaming about 150 scenarios of how the Trump administration might try to interfere with the election, and they're coming up with possible solutions. So this mailing situation is one of those 150, and they feel prepared with the response.
I mean, do you think this creates some confusion, again, just 2 months out from Election Day?
Sure. I mean, it could create mass confusion, and there are 20 different states that in just the next couple of weeks are going to start sending out different types of ballots, whether they be absentee ballots, mail-in ballots, et cetera. And let's remember that the Constitution specifies that it is states and to some degree Congress that have supremacy over how votes will actually take place. It's not the executive branch. So we have a bit of a, you know, the term gets used so often, constitutional crisis, but at least in terms of voting and in this respect, there is mass confusion at minimum and quite a crisis coming at maximum.
Yeah, and another issue that's drawn some confusion, too, is this whole issue of redistricting in certain parts of the country. We know that there were some key rulings just yesterday, including in Missouri, which, of course, blocked a new Republican-drawn map. Also in Maryland, we saw that a Democratic-drawn map will now go to voters. So just kind of level set for us, kind of who's up and who's down here with some of these decisions.
Foremost, the Supreme Court, and almost certainly is going to have this before them, whether they actually take action that will pertain to the 2026 midterms remains to be seen, but you can expect that that process is going to work its way forward. But we're running out of time here, and people have to vote. And whether they're voting by mail or in person, that this is what needs to be done. And ultimately, it is really going to be a case, especially in these couple of states that are still basically, they have live balls as to where the districts are going to lie, what the maps are going to read. This is going to be a major problem for candidates in particular who don't even necessarily know where they're running and who their voters are.
And your quick thoughts, Riley, just on kind of what this means for the state of play and the balance of power come November.
Yeah, I can say that House Democrats are enthused by what they saw in recent days. The maps that are going to get a vote in Missouri and in Maryland are positive things for Democrats. If there hadn't been the decision to go forward with a referendum in Missouri, for example, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, a Hakeem Jeffries ally, would probably have lost his seat. His seat had been carved in three different directions. So Democrats are enthused, but there's a lot still to play out here. Part of this will go to the voters in November, so we'll see.
Yeah, a lot to follow here. So cheers on that note to the holiday weekend. Thank you so much, Riley Rogerson and Dave Leventhal. Next, a victory for LSU's football team before even taking the field. At a preview of this week's first full slate of action, you are watching The Takeout.
Welcome back to The Takeout. The LSU Tigers football team is celebrating their first win of the season before even taking the field. Last night, a judge ruled that the school could roster two players who had brief stints with NFL teams. Attorneys for the SEC say they plan to file an appeal. Ross Dellinger is a senior writer for Yahoo Sports, and he joins us now. This has got a lot of folks talking, Ross. So what does this case and legal battle say about the state of college football?
Well, it says it's quite a mess, right? We're here we are on the brink, the eve, right, of the first full Saturday of college football in 2026. And we're talking about a court case, right? So many reporters gathered around a Baton Rouge courthouse on Thursday. It's indicative of sort of the uncertain and maybe rudderless landscape of college athletics. And right now, to use a sports term, you know, the ball is in LSU's court, right? A Baton Rouge judge granted a group of athletes a fifth season of eligibility, several of them signed pro contracts in the NFL and then got cut and want to come back. LSU recruited those players and have commitments from several of those players. So the court paved the way for LSU to add those players to the roster, but that would violate NCAA and SEC policies. And the SEC has certainly threatened to enforce its rules upon LSU to the point that it actually filed a federal lawsuit against LSU asking a federal judge to allow it to enforce its rules. And those rules and those penalties are certainly very strict. Half a season suspension for a head coach. There's talk of suspending LSU as a school, maybe even expelling them from the SEC. Those are discussions being had at the top level of SEC administrators.
Well, turning now to the actual action that's on the field this weekend, of course, LSU Tigers face Clemson this weekend. So preview this matchup for us.
Yeah, this is an easy one. I think even without all of the eligibility drama, the Clemson-LSU game in Baton Rouge is the headliner of the opening weekend. Lane Kiffin's debut as coach of the Tigers, a Saturday night game in Tiger Stadium against Dabo Sweeney. He's got a new offensive coordinator. He's got a new starting quarterback there at Clemson. You throw in all the drama, right, around the eligibility a fiasco, and you got yourself sort of an elite scene in Baton Rouge. There's another game, though, Saturday that I think is intriguing. Baylor goes and plays actually in Atlanta against Auburn, and the Bears have at QB former Florida Gator starter DJ Lagway, who was ranked as the number one player in high school out of the 2024 recruiting class, struggled a bit last year in Gainesville, and so then he got a new home, right? He went home. He's from Texas originally, so the Auburn-Baylor game is certainly intriguing, especially Auburn, right? They have a new coach, whole new team. Basically, Alex Golish came over from South Florida, brought a lot of players with him, including Byron Brown, who's one of the most electric sort of quarterbacks we might see this year in college football.
Hey, and speaking of that, of course, heading into this first week of the season, who is on your Heisman watch?
Yeah, well, you got to look at three quarterbacks: Oregon quarterback Dante Moore, Texas quarterback Arch Manning, and Ole Miss has Trinidad Chambliss. Moore bypassed the NFL draft to return to the Ducks, and so did a lot of others on that team. In fact, a lot of people think Oregon could be the fourth different Big Ten team in 4 years to win it all, win the conference and win the national title. They certainly got the quarterback to do it. We saw late last season, Arch Manning really hit on all cylinders. I think he's gone more than 100 pass attempts without throwing an interception. Texas is kind of my team to beat to win it all. And then Trinidad, right, got a sixth year of eligibility. From a Mississippi judge back in February. He's an elite passer, great decision maker, and has good instincts.
All right, Ross Dellinger, thanks so much, and happy Friday to you and to everyone. That does it for us here on The Takeout.